Okay, good afternoon. This is the Historic Landmarks Commission meeting for February 24th, 2020. I'd like to begin by introducing first Bureau of Development Services staff,
Hillary Adam.
The members of the commission here today are
Andrew Smith,
Maya Fody,
Annie Mahoney,
Kristen Miner,
Matthew Roman,
Derek Spears.
Commission members are private citizens appointed by the mayor. We are not paid but serve entirely as volunteers. More detailed information regarding the purpose and function of the commission can be found in the Portland Zoning Code. Commission members must declare a conflict of interest, bias, or ex parte contact prior to the staff presentation of a particular case. If a commission member has a conflict of interest or bias, they are not allowed to participate in commission discussion or voting on that project. If a commission member has had an ex parte contact, they must declare the substance of it on the record, and it is subject to rebuttal. Let's see, on our agenda today, we have a briefing and then several design advice requests. So I think, are there any items of interest we need to get out of the way initially? I can think of Hillary.
I don't think there's anything that we need to discuss. We do have a State of the City coming up. And of course, I'm blanking on the date right now, but
I think it's the 18th of March.
18th of March,
right? Yeah, I hope hope a lot of commissioners can make it.
10:15 a.m. It would be great if everybody could go, and if you have ideas on potential speakers, because we usually do get some invited testimony, that'd be great to share with Kristen and Maya or myself.
Yeah. That would be great. So, you know, if you have any ideas, please do email, you know, me, Maya, and always, of course, CC Hillary. And we're trying to come up with a short list right now of folks who might want to come in and say a few words on our behalf and in support of the nice report that we put together with so much work. Okay. I think we can go ahead and start with the briefing then.
Okay. I would like to invite Bill Hawkins and Eric Jacobson from Prosper Portland and Stephanie Whitlock from the Architectural Heritage Center up. I did provide a memo, and the booklet that included that memo was prepared by Bill Hawkins, and then you also received a letter from Chrissy Curran from SHPO. Yeah, as long as the red light is on.
The microphone has to have the red light on. Good afternoon. Thank you so much for the invitation to come make a presentation to you and for a conversation about the cast iron collection. My name is Eric Jacobson. I'm a project manager with Prosper Portland.
I'm Stephanie Whitlock, the executive director of the Bosco Milligan Foundation Architectural Heritage Center.
Bill Hawkins. I was here 70 years ago when the first cast iron was viewed.
Make sure his microphone's on. So we're going to talk for about 15 minutes or so. We really want this to be more of a conversation, but we did want to make a quick presentation and give you some background. Some of it's going to be a little bit of a repeat over the information Bill already gave you or that Hillary put in her memo to you. But just a quick summary of why we're here. Portland has had one of the most extensive concentrations of cast iron buildings in the United States. Those buildings were built largely between 1853 and 1899. And I understand the other two cities with notable collections are New York and San Francisco, although San Francisco's, I think, was disrupted by the earthquake. And then beginning in the 1930s and really accelerating in the 1950s and 1960s, some of those buildings were torn down. And at that time, there were advocates who worked to salvage some of those cast iron fronts. And those, most notably, they were Eric Ladd, Jerry Bosco, and Ben Milligan. And then our very own Bill here participated in some of that, and he'll be able to share some of his own personal history as well. Prosper Portland bought what we call the Eric Ladd Collection in 2002. And the purpose was to for a public agency to own it and to work actively to try to have those materials reintegrated into new developments. And we, Prosper Portland, has an agreement with the Bosco Milligan Foundation where we dispose of those materials in collaboration with the Bosco Milligan Foundation. So when people come to us with a request for certain pieces, I or somebody at Prosper, like me, consults with Bill and Stephanie to make sure that it's in fitting with the keeping of the purpose of the collection. And we've recently done that on two projects. One is the Worldmark Hotel, which is open about a year ago or so, and the 38 Davis Building on the other side of Burnside, where there's a cast iron sort of display outside that building. So there's really three elements that have come together in the past recent about encouraging reintroduction of the cast iron. So the first is Prosper Portland's ownership of the collection. Second is the Skidmore Old Town Historic Design Guidelines, which have a criteria related to cast iron design elements. And then the third is a resolution adopted by the City Council, a resolution 37207, which encourages city bureaus to prioritize the reuse of the artifacts from the collection in the historic district. So those three things are all supposed to sort of work together to encourage the reintroduction of the cast iron into new developments. And so one of the reasons why we're here is we have successfully done that in the recent past, but then we had a project that came through in the past year where we had some contact with the architect and design team. And I understand you had some contact with the architect and design team, but then it didn't come together. And that was kind of important because it was on a property that's identified as a priority property for reuse of the cast iron. And in the collection, there were three artifacts that were from that property. So there were two columns and an arch that comprised an archway. And so there was an opportunity to include an archway from that original site into the new project. And it didn't happen. And so that's one of the reasons we kind of asked the question was, is there something about the way we are coordinating amongst ourselves that could be improved? And that's really why we're here, is to have that conversation. So I'll turn it now over to Bill to talk a little bit more about the history.
Greetings to the Landmark Commission. I literally meant it that my introduction to this collection was 70 years ago. I was in high school when I first saw it. I worked for Eric Ladd. Now, he was the person who actually salvaged all this iron, the main person. I worked in a little shop he had because he was a friend of my aunt's and I needed a Christmas job. And I saw piled up behind the Cam House an enormous pile of cast iron pieces. They quite intrigued me. One was a very 1850s or 60s cast iron arch, a typical pattern of that era where fire was a huge danger to the early cities. And it had essentially two columns, two beams faced with cast iron pilasters. It had an archway integral with it. It had panels for fire shutters. And of course, where the doorway went. This was repeated over and over and over, first in San Francisco and then in Portland foundries, and became the leading architectural style of the late 1850s and 1860s in Portland. Now, as a future architect, it intrigued me. Nobody talked about this iron. Eric had a great dream for it in the colony of reconstructing a village, a small town with all this iron. But nobody had any idea where the buildings had been, where they came from, how many were there, and it simply sat there for years and years and years. Then it was, he sold his property. He was not a businessman in any sense. Although he had moved the Cam House, he moved the Lincoln House, he moved the St. Mary's Chapel, and he had done various projects around Portland, his benefactor ran out of money. And he ceased doing these historic projects. Finally, when the Cam House was sold to Peter Hoffman, all the iron was moved off the site to the famous Dyack Farm beside an old shed building where it was stacked very high with little cords between it. And it was there for decades and decades. Finally, Bill Failing is here today. He knew about this collection. I knew about this collection. We approached PDC at the time. They were very enthusiastic, and they bought the whole thing from the Eric Ladd estate with high hopes. And of course, you have heard about the high hopes. The city got very interested in it. PDC got very interested in it. They really hoped to take the Skidmore Historic District and have it as a magnet to the city, a draw such as the Japanese Garden would be, the Chinese Garden would be, you know, clearly one of the features of Portland. We thought the city would give the appearance that it had been here a long time. It was the metropolis of the Northwest. It was a city of some stature, the first opera house, symphony, so on and so forth. It would pay attention to the fact we weren't born yesterday. Then it was moved again to the east side when PDC bought it, Prosper Portland, and finally moved to a bridge, another bridgehead, kind of under where the Markham Bridge comes off the river, proceeds north, and there it sits today. You have to imagine the times when Eric Ladd was saving this in the early 1950s. No one's quite sure. There are a few articles in the paper that describe the demolition of these buildings, how sad it was to lose our old architecture, the beginnings of the city, lots of articles on we're not paying attention to our past and so forth. But generally, it was an era of ennui. People did not care. Progress were cars and tearing down buildings, providing parking lots, and the need was there. There was an underlying current that the blocks by the river now and then had floods. It was not good for business or buildings. Buildings were going uptown, I should say up to higher grade by the Pioneer Courthouse, and the city moved west. So this whole situation of what to do with the landmarks there have been dozens of people working on this. City commissions, interested citizens, heads of the landmarks were saying, we are the conservators of this district. We are conservators of the iron. We should see that good things happen to it. We should see that our district is enhanced for the very reason that it became a landmark, i.e. Portland was totally unique in being founded in the 1840s at the beginning of the cast iron era in New York, where cast iron buildings were becoming the rage, fireproof buildings were becoming the rage. It immediately came west. Western foundries were established. Portland had its iron out in Oswego. It was totally ripe for being a cast iron fronted city. The singular reason that we were given a National Historic Landmark status is the fact that this is unique in the world. Now, there have been other reasons for it being named an historic district, but you can travel the world. There's a cast iron fountain in Peru. There is the English have their bridges and their railway stations, and the French and all over Europe. There's a building here, there's a building there. But very few had a city born when the iron era began and ended. And Portland happened to be one of them. For that reason, we were given this particular status. How important is that to the city? You know, mobs of people for the last 70 years, it seems, in planning and development and what have you, have been interested in this problem, wanting to make our historic district special and concentrate on the reason it was given this status. So I have here a variety of show and tells. If they're of interest to anybody, I have photographs of the iron when it was up behind the Cam House. This is that arch I spoke of, which intrigued me when I was in high school, because the fire shutters were still there in this arch. I don't know where it disappeared to. It's gone. It was an extremely important element for Portland's history. That iron was so predominant that the largest collection of it was in this collection that we have now, Eric Ladd's collection. And some of it is installed on that building between Pine and Stark on Old Front Street. So I have that. I have photographs of the district when it was in its heyday, before it all came down. The one photograph I want you to see is on the bottom here, where it was a classic little square. Beautiful arch buildings around in the background. The buildings going south on First, this is looking east, were all arched. The New Market Theater was arched. It was the rhythm of the city in cast iron, buildings 2 and 3 stories high. That is what we lost when demo began in the late 20s, and when Burnside was widened, we lost a few buildings. Then it really got up until after the war, where cars were just the demanding factor. Cars are sacred. Property taxes are, you can't earn living on a block with low rent tenants, a lot of Chinese. So the buildings came down massively. I have a lot of things to show here if people are interested. Of course, George's book was the first one to pay attention. The first photographs are the minor white art photographs of the city. The museum thought they were art buildings, the way we don't describe buildings anymore, and paid Minor White to photograph them, these very romantic photographs of gorgeous arches, 1930s type workers standing there holding up the column. And he also photographed the Jacobs Mansions and the Knapp Mansion. So these buildings, that era that we've lost, were considered art, just a different time, different strokes for different folks. One more fact, and I'll let Stephanie talk. It's hard to describe the American dream in the 1880s or so, but Portland prospered greatly after the Civil War. And to achieve the American dream in Portland, if you'd amassed a fortune from the Oregon Steam Navigation Company or the railroad or something, or sending wheat to China, whatever it was, your name was established when you built a palace, adding to the art of the city. And those palaces were all fronted in cast iron. It seems very odd that that was more than important than anything, that you have a beautiful building to represent your name was on it, the date of construction, but that established your success in the American dream. All of that's lost. We look at everything differently today. But given the fact that we have this unique tradition, given the fact that most of us destroyed, given the fact that Eric Ladd saved it, that Prosper Portland has it, that is the basic thing that we're dealing with. So I'm hoping this will be a good discussion, and we're very glad to have you interested in this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a few brief.
So we wanted to present a few points that we think could make for some really interesting discussion. These have come out of our work and conversations together, and also with some of the Landmark staff. And I know we have about the rest of the hour today. So and this is only the tip of the iceberg, too, we realize. And we won't necessarily have answers to some of these questions, but they just provide some good food for thought. One question is about implementation, and how is the reuse of the cast iron implemented, and perhaps implemented in a more systematic way? The district's design guidelines of 2016 have the expectation that every effort will be made to reuse the cast iron in the district, but what are the mechanisms for addressing this expectation? Should there even be a presumption of reintroduction of the cast iron artifacts, and especially in the priority locations identified in the guidelines, and especially when the artifacts from those specific properties actually exist within the collection? And can we get a better understanding of the priorities for using the cast iron and the various ways it can be integrated into the buildings? And what creative uses of the cast iron might be possible, might exist, which leads to a second broad question about integrating the old and the new. And this is a tough one, we know, but can we get some clarity on the goals for preserving this very special landmark district who is designated or so unique because of its cast iron, weighing that against the new buildings and the design challenges that they may pose in terms of reusing the cast iron. Without a doubt, we can really appreciate some of the design dilemmas that we have encountered and that we will continue to encounter. We know that. Lastly, a question about the institutional relationships and partnerships to oversee the project of reintegrating or using the cast iron. This is both now and also for the long term. But what is the relationship of this commission to the Ladd Collection and to Prosper Portland in this matter? Between the applicants you might see for a design review and Prosper Portland, should this relationship be more formalized? Should we look at the procedures? Is this commission willing to be this body that makes recommendations about the cast iron and its use over time? Or would it be appropriate for another entity or committee to do that and report to you all? Or just who else should be involved in this matter? So again, just some food for thought, and I'll turn it back over to Eric.
Thanks. Yeah, I think that really concludes what we wanted to convey. I mean, we're here to be partners with you to implement the reintroduction of the cast iron as best we can. I think that's a city goal, so we're all trying to work for that. And then lastly, before turning over to a discussion, I did want to say, we have the collection. It's across the river by the East Bank Esplanade. I would like to extend an invitation to anybody who wants to come see it. I can work with Hillary to arrange a tour. It wouldn't take very long. We have it in a little storage area, and it's fairly close to here. So if you ever want to do that, just I can coordinate through Hillary to make that happen. But otherwise, that really concludes our presentation. Really want to open up to a conversation.
Thank you. I really appreciate you coming in here, and I appreciate all the materials that you put together, especially you, Bill. This is a conversation that I know all of my fellow commissioners really appreciate. This is, you know, as you said, it's not necessarily easy, and I think there are some gaps in, you know, the sort of implementation and sort of who knows, you know, who knows best, you know, about how to actually take pieces and what they are. You know, we rely on the applicants many times, and that's spotty. You know, it's not necessarily something they're familiar with. And so I think, you know, when they come back and report to us, oh, we've seen the collection, you know, yikes, we don't really, you know, we don't want to go there. And, you know, we don't have the resources necessarily to sort of chase that down and say, well, you know, there is actually a complete set that could go, you know, on this location and push back against that. But let me start with a question about what I think all of us would consider to be a success story, which is the Halleck and Macmillan. You know, there was this great video and everything of that restoration. But I'm also aware that some of those pieces were recreated rather than reused. And I wonder if any of you have an idea about why that was.
They were recreated in iron.
Right.
Off of photographs of the original building, good photographs, historic photographs.
Yeah.
John Russell wanted an authentic restoration on that building.
And it looks amazing.
It does. I went by there again the other day, and, you know, for someone who's been in the business for a long time, it's really extremely satisfying to see a restored building. Now, that's the oldest standing building in the city.
Yeah.
So you have to say, what is the value of an historic district for Portland? Does it want to show it wasn't started yesterday? Should the historic be historic? Well, it's never going to be. Ideally, you would have at least a little area that is as much like an historic district as you could make it, if it's to be valid for the very reason it's kept. Portland was started in the 1840s. By the 1850s, they had iron-fronted buildings. And through the 1880s, they were almost all cast iron fronted buildings. What do you do with the Skidmore Historic District where half the buildings are missing? Obviously, infills is the only way it's going to happen. Nothing has happened for decades. A building here and there, finally Mercy Corps. There was a building on Pine that got done. An okay design. It kind of had Italianate proportions. But the great question is, can we ever do anything like Europe did or Eastern Europe after the communists wiped out all historic cities or God knows what? What is right to show a dignified area, something worth going to see, particularly when half the buildings are missing? So I personally think the art of an infill building per se, as an infill building, not an historic reproduction,
right,
has come a long way. It's come from the flat-walled glass curtain wall of Mercy Corps to what I would call, gosh, it really does have kind of Italianate proportions. It's under 75 feet. No, it may be two or three floors higher than they had in the old days, but they've squished everything down to try to make that work, get more floors in.
Yeah.
We have lots of thoughts about how it might go.
I have a super quick question, a process question. Is there an inventory? Where we have dimensions, we know exactly what we have in that collection.
No, if you had a little tour, that's the best way to see it.
Well, but no, that's not the question. We don't have an inventory.
Yes, we have an inventory.
With sizes.
Commissioned by a national grant, paid for by them, PDC. It has every item known in it. Sure. And the Landmarks has a copy, or used to have a copy.
So if I'm an architect and I'm designing a new building, and I say, what's the connection? Where do they go to get that? How do they know about it? Process.
I think the way the process works is, I think there's two things. One is they read the guidelines, and oftentimes they're proactive, and they might call me, for example, or somebody at Prosper. And the other is through a DAR or an early application. There may be a conversation with staff around that, and staff may say, oh, by the way, Prosper has the collection, you should go check it out. So one way or another, some of those applicants do come, find their way to us one way or another, and we have a conversation, we go over the inventory. Oftentimes they'll go out and ask for a tour and see the pieces in person.
Okay. Thank you, that was my
answer. It's usually a fait accompli before we even hear about it. We have selected some, before I hear about it, we have selected some pieces and we're gonna do it this and this way. And you say, yeah, but it's not a smorgasbord. No, if you have a complete arch, it should go together as an arch. You shouldn't have one of this and one of that, half of an arch and one of this and one of that. I personally disagree with the smorgasbord idea, but very glad that someone did something. Mm-hmm. And that example, then there are all sorts of other approaches that architects have taken on their own. It would die to say, can we be in on this discussion from the beginning? We recommend this piece because it was on this site. And there might, of the 10 ways that you might display it, from on the sidewalk to in the lobby to on the facade to do something, there must be something that you can do. If they're modern architects, we'll say, now, come on. I know Corbusier wanted to tear down all of Paris. He was not a preservationist. But, you know, you're in this historic district. You should do something. And while I feel that each and every way may be a valid way, a lot of these architects have never heard of Corinthian column and have no idea what Italianate proportion is, have no idea what a Corinthian column is or an acanthus leaf. You start with zero, and you're glad to get whatever they do, which is usually minimal. Mm-hmm. We would yearn to have a structure that had you involved and say, these are the 10 ways you could do something. This is what we highly prefer. If you have an archway, it'd be kept an archway. You know, is it a freestanding object in front of the building? Is it on the sidewalk? Is it in the lobby? Mercy Corps was nothing but had hard knocks for those who were very interested in iron that was originally on that site. It got so tangled up in SHPO's rules, what I thought were massive misinterpretation of the rules, But if you read it for the first time, you say, well, this is what they meant, you know. No iron. Well, they didn't say that. But they took the clause that kind of sounded like modern architecture will have precedence, and so you do a modern building. Well, that may be work fine when you have one building in a historic district somewhere that's sympathetic and goes with everything. But when you have half a district, that means that the final district will be modern, essentially modern, much like the Pearl District or downtown Portland even. Historic building there, here and there, some modern buildings, heights no problem. The only things that are unusual about the Mercy Corps building is it kept the 75 feet and it colored it red, which is the color of the warehouse that was next door. So coming up with a list of a reasonable request to do it and a pre-plan instead of being given a fait accompli, this is what we've selected, and then having to deal with it. There is no formal program. There's no very simple logic to what is done. We're just grateful that something was done.
Mm-hmm. I would second what Commissioner Miner said, though. I do appreciate you coming in. You know, we did review the latest building, and there was mention that it would be incorporated, and I know for myself, I didn't realize the importance of it, or the it was just mentioned that it was going to be incorporated. We didn't really push how it would be incorporated. And so I really appreciate you kind of coming in to school us a little bit and sort of even starting that conversation, because it was, I mean, I know what it is, I'm aware of it, but it wasn't, that was such a good example of, okay, well, here it is, here's an example. It would have been a tough conversation. It's a very modern building. I mean, how do you incorporate it in any way? Maybe that's not our problem. That's this very talented design team's problem. But at least the conversation would have been there. It kind of just flew off my radar. So I really appreciate you guys.
With it, we could go back and readdress that particular problem. But that was a building that happened not to be photographed often. So it wasn't in my book on cast iron.
Historic one on that lot.
It was the Reed's Bank.
Okay.
A corner entrance cast iron fronted building. But if one had a set of rules, everyone was involved, and say, hey, a freestanding object, start from the beginning, let it be a freestanding art, let it be incorporated, let it be on the sidewalk, let it be in the lobby, let it be something. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, had one known, one could put the word out, does anyone have a photograph of the building? Well, there was a very vague one that ZGF had. So vague, you couldn't really tell there was an archway there. Then there were the etchings of the 1870s. There's an early 1870s building, very Baroque, really. And that showed it had a cornice, very elaborate cornice, and an almost undisciplined Baroque. It wasn't a great Baroque building, but it was a fine-looking building. And Minor White photographed it on his famous photographing the buildings around Portland, and when he did the Jacobs Mansions. And it was a very simple cast iron front. These arches and these columns and the arch are what remain, that's all. And you know, since then, of course, one's been able to draw a little drawing. I can empathize with the architects. They did, a very Italianate building. I have here a drawing somewhere of their elevation that they did. And you know, offhand, I put a cast iron building before it, I'd say it was very compatible. This is the Blagan block. Same, the floor shorter, the floors lined up. No, the feeling of it was kind of Italianate, I would say. They hit it on the proportion aspect. And you know, a lot of these architects have no clue when you're talking about proportion. They don't know the old-fashioned terms for architecture. And it's hard to relate on that score. But curiously enough, and I'd love to know, they certainly didn't share their philosophy, that archway, if you're thinking of it in the facade, just happens to be tall enough, just happens to be wide enough, it could have been an entrance arch. If you're a modern architect, having a cast iron arch in a modern building, should you say, okay, it's a compromise, we'll do it. If you're pure, they'd say, oh, this just
no, I cannot deal with it. I cannot deal with it. But they could have. They could have done that. They could certainly have planted in the sidewalk on the side. It's 12 feet wide. You know, if we have benches and fountains and trees, you know, we can have a little arch like this. So one can look at these things in retrospect and say, had it had some attention paid to it, had we put the lookout for people who collect old photographs and know every building site in Portland, there's an army of consultants out there, and they're totally devoted, absolute sleuths, to early Portland history. No, Portland Landmarks should have a tap into those people. They know 100 times more than most historians, 100 times more than I do, and all you do is push the button, and within a day, we got a photograph back taken by no less than famous Minor White, who became nationally known as a photographer. We want something to happen. No, something. Not, there's enough talent here to say our historic district is worth special attention, not just to fall through the cracks.
So what if there was some, what if there was a group that could maybe attend pre-ops in the district and specifically provide information about the cast iron components that, you know, perhaps were associated with that site, or even another site that, you know, could be usable to make sure that the architecture team knew that, and that information could then be, you know, collected and given to the staff planner to take forward. It just seems like relying on the applicants for that information, and it's not that, I mean, for instance, you know, the PAE building, certainly they talked about it a little bit, so it's not like they, you know, it's not like they came in with nothing. And ultimately, I don't know if the outcome would have been a lot different. They, I don't think, had a lot of interest in using, you know, any components on the outside, but we certainly could have talked about it more. The chances would have been better.
What about a vision for, I mean, as the owners of the collection and the curators of it, in a sense, is anyone want to put the resources into hiring someone like Mr. Hawkins to, put a vision for here's what we have and here's how we think it should be used in the district? Because I think I even misunderstood that arch and that it was from that site. And I read Mrs. Kern's letter, and I have no problem with the argument that she makes, and I have no resistance to using it. I just think you've got all these different cooks in town, and none of them know what they're cooking. They're all trying to make a recipe that no one knows what the vision for it is. And I agree with Mr. Hawkins. I think a lot of people are resistant to using it if they're modernists, and they think it's something that they'll try to not photograph when they take a picture of the building. So if there was a vision of here's how it should be used, that would always be something that we could reference every time a building came in, because we would know, mm-hmm. Hey, this site doesn't, there's no cast iron. Maybe it's an appropriate site for a reinvention of a, you know, modern twist or something. But in a case where this material came from this site, it's the most appropriate site to put it. Just understanding what the priorities are, because that's my responsibility to find out what the priorities are, and I don't know that I did well enough in that case. But, you know, we would love to know what the vision is for it, even to Commissioner Fote's comment about is there a catalog, and I can assure you none of us have any papers. All the papers that are kept are kept in the sacred file, but it would be great to have access to what the catalog actually is, because one of the things we get is people say, oh, we went over there, and they don't want to dig around in the pile. They don't have a vision for it. So they just describe all the problems about how they can't do this and they can't do that. And there's no advocate during that day that's here saying, hey, wait a minute. You know, you have to be, not you, but holding us to task, because you know, we're only hearing the argument from the applicant or whoever else came and likes or disliked their building and doing our best to try to apply the guidelines. But, you know, I wish they'd have written it shall be, not should be. You know, it's one of those must be, because.
Well, it has to be dynamically a must be, I think. And if you do this for our National Historic Landmark District, whatever money you spend on something that enhances the district will come right off your property taxes. Something that reaches home. Right now, you know, when you talk to most of these are architects who've never had a class in architectural history, have no idea what you're talking about. Go over, look at that pile. Oh my God, what's the least we can do to
terrified.
Check this off? No, it's kind of scary to them.
Yeah.
And if the Landmarks Commission has a background, or at least a, I don't know if they have a library, but you know, this could apply to general knowledge of terracotta. You know, if someone comes in, they want to do something. Well, Portland has a fabulous collection of terracotta buildings. We think you ought to do such and such. I quite agree that there has to be something more that reaches home. That just isn't there. There's no structure at all.
To add on to Commissioner Roman, I almost wonder if we need, is this the only text that in this letter that is in the guidelines that is related to
pretty much
the cast iron? Because it's so vague.
You could succeed in having all the cast iron used, but just not in a very good way. Because everyone's approaching it that sort of, I don't want to do this sort of way. And if someone had the vision to say, here's how this district should look with all these parts we have and put it out there, then it's harder for people to argue against
it. It needs to be aspirational. And I think the hard part for us is that for reviewing approval criteria and guidelines, we put the burden on the applicant to prove that they're meeting them, right? So I don't know that we can sort of direct on how and what to use, but I agree with Commissioner Miner's idea of having a group at the early assistance or pre-app to guide the applicant towards that.
I feel like a step ahead of that, which is super important, is to, I mean, is there any way to link something to the guidelines? Here's a link. And even if it's just like some sort of, you know, some ideas as to how this, what are concrete ways this can be done, and sort of have it in writing in some form so that people now can sort of click on it. It's associated with the guidelines. This is the history of the cast iron. This is what we have. This is where it's located. This is who you contact. These are some of the ways they've been reused in the past. This is what the aspiration is. So something more concrete than just, yeah, it'd be awesome if you guys can reuse it if possible. Because that's just sort of like, and then when they come in here and they're like, yeah, we tried, it didn't work. Mm-hmm. And they're like, yeah, bummer. Gosh, okay, next.
And I agree. And I think for me, I mean, it's wonderful hearing about the district and just the expanse of cast iron, because I don't have a great, you know, picture of it except for individual photographs. Essentially, of buildings. And to have a project come in using one single piece seems like a waste to me when you don't get the full experience of what it was like. And I don't know if there's some way, I guess that's the aspirational image or hope that I would want to see as a touchstone for anybody looking to use the collection.
Definitely. And then our role would be more like, this was a wonderful way of interpreting these guidelines and how they laid it out, as opposed to having to be the cop, like whether you did it or not. Because then it's way out of our purview, and designing something as well is very difficult. I mean, so it seems like there's like one more step that needs to be taken, which is first making it black and white in some form.
Right.
I don't know what that is, but you guys is the, what did happen with the $280,000 or whatever that was given in this letter from SHPO mentions a chunk of money that was given.
The
that disappeared. It was
just wasn't spent.
Good.
I would have just. So it's still there.
No.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, I'm there. Sure.
Problem solved. You hired him at some point.
I would imagine the funds were never. I mean, I don't know, but they were never distributed, and then the grant was closed, or at least returned. Okay. Yeah, I think it's probably too old to reopen that.
Related to the question about the appropriateness of items, or say from one site being used on another site, do you guys want to talk a little bit about a sort of a, where in between the modernist and the sort of purist, because it's not, we don't want to make the wrong decision, but it's certainly not a, you know, it's not a perfect science in terms of, you know, if we knew the cast iron came from this site, but that now has a building on it, is it appropriate then that we'll put it on the other site? Those are the you know, questions that I weigh in my mind of, you know, you want to interpret it in the right way. And again, having an advocate for it and someone that's got the knowledge to be that advocate, which relates back to Commissioner Miner's comments. But it's, you know, it speaks to Commissioner Mahoney as well, the single object, you know, stuck on the building. I guess it's just the desire to see it done well and have examples or what would make you happy, I guess, is the question.
Yeah. Well, and you, I mean, if how to enhance this district on the Mercy Corps building where some artifacts somehow remain, very few. It was one of the most gorgeous palatial buildings you can imagine. Three stories of gorgeous cast iron, very much looking like anything you'd find in Baroque Venice. Mm-hmm. Well, the discussions way back then was this horror of not following the SHPO rules where the addition has to be modern. Well, this part is obviously not modern. Well, couldn't you put it in the lobby with a display? Now, that particular project on that lot was, it was owned by Simeon Reed, who founded Reed College. Now, clearly a major person of the early citizens who had prospered very much and done something really great for the city. It was a perfect opportunity to say, well, at least a little plaque. This property was owned by Simeon Reed. He built a palace here, established his name. He was among the leading citizens of the, and he helped found the art museum or blah, 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 and intellectual life, all these things. It ended up with nothing. No little scroll on the wall, no little blown up mural, no mention of, you would ever know that Simeon Reed had anything to do with that project. The architects felt they were pure, they'd done exactly what they wanted. They're modern architects, they're very talented, but nothing. Well, surely there should have been something. It wasn't a minor citizen, it was the major people in the city.
We do have new guidelines now, yeah, which I think are much better at you know, requiring, yeah, some thought to be given to the cast iron collection. And it may not spell it out, you know, exactly, thou shalt, but it's also not, don't worry about it. So it's somewhere in between those.
And the public realm is still the public realm, and so that's not entirely a lost opportunity. I mean, it's not,
right,
obviously a current public works project, but it could be put back there.
And that brings up another point. And, you know, Bill, you had said a couple of times that you could see a project using these artifacts kind of more, you know, in the sidewalk. And so I wonder if there is an opportunity to talk to PBOT about, I mean, for instance, we had another project in which they were requiring the property lines to, you know, set back a few feet, you know, to give a full 15-foot sidewalk. And I think this commission was pushing back hard against that because, of course, that would have created a jog in the street front for no reason. But at the same time, is there a way that there are some of those artifacts that could come back, you know, within the edge of the public right of way? So do you see that as potentially, you know, part of the solution? I mean, obviously you would prefer to have them on buildings, you know, for good reason, but what do you think about that idea of actually?
I am frankly open to anything. Mm-hmm. I think there has to be compromise in the thinking if something's to be done. You know, when I was asked to go and speak to the architects, I was impressed by them. They're very well educated. They seem to know the language of classical architecture. They weren't disrespectful of it. And, you know, in my mind, I said, well, just jog the building over, put the freestanding arch, say this was from the original building on this site, make it into an entrance to a little shop or something. Freestanding, it wouldn't affect the purity of the building behind it. Buildings are cut off all the time. No, I was just flowing with ideas, and they got all excited, and then nothing.
Nothing.
The argument against the interior thing was there. It's, you know, it's an all self-reliant building, whatever. And right. Of course, when it got down to, well, why don't you put it in the lobby? Well, it's too heavy. You know, and our water tank storage is right below it. You know, how do we support it? Blah, 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 ping, clink, ka-ching, ka-ching, ching. You're just asking a monstrous thing of us.
Yeah.
Oof, it vanished. I've heard I could write a huge book on all the reasons I've heard why this is, God, cast iron. You're just blowing my mind. I can't think of anything.
We've heard many of those reasons ourselves.
Yeah, I'd say over the past few months, we've thought about this question, some of the things you're bringing up. I think we've thought about it. So in terms of vision, well, first of all, I think we've heard, I think the idea of making sure applicants have access to the electronic catalog would be a really great idea. I don't know if they do right now, but it is something that would be easily done, I think. In terms of a vision, I think we kind of acknowledge that that vision doesn't necessarily exist. One of the reasons Bill put this packet together was try to do that a little bit. And there's a couple things he did that. First is there's pictures of different ways the cast iron's been integrated, sometimes outside of a building, sometimes in a lobby, sometimes in a sidewalk. So I feel like we're open to all those kinds of ideas. The other thing Bill did is he identified these priorities, the idea of keeping the collection together and as close to where its original location as possible. And he's identified some real opportunities there with a map showing where those are.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing we identified was, as I mentioned, like they came and talked to us, but I really wasn't talking to Hillary. And so, and maybe just because I thought I had a different impression maybe of how the process was going to go. So, like, I never communicated to Hillary, oh, by the way, we have an archway from that property. It'd be really great if we could integrate it into the building. Yeah. We had that conversation with the architects, like Bill's talking about. And then the next I heard about it was when they asked if they could use just the columns in the lobby. And that's when we said, well, no, not just the columns. It has to be the whole archway. And then by then, they had already designed the whole building. And it was kind of like, well, now what? You know. But I think, you know, the idea of sidewalks or other locations, you know, I don't think anybody wants it to look fake or like it's just applied in a fake way. I don't think that is success. But and so that's why we're a little bit hesitant to like put a real strong vision out there and, you know, let architects use their creativity. But I think we are open to different ways of displaying the artifacts.
Okay.
Well, even just this is super helpful. Yeah. Some of these ideas. Just so people have an idea of how that could be done, you know.
Yeah.
And then again, it does need to be something that's procedural because, I mean, the commission's going to change in a couple of years and you guys are going to retire and change and move. And
right.
No, it's we can't just depend on this one conversation today. That's the institutional knowledge is going to disappear in a couple of years.
Yeah.
In my case, probably by tomorrow. No,
yeah.
But you know what I mean? It has to be something that's concrete.
I feel like may I say something? I don't mean to cut you off, but I do have an idea and I don't want to forget it. At the staff level, I feel like we could put together an SOP for projects in Skidmore Old Town that refers to this document that lists out the priorities, gives a clue as to what may be available, have a reference to that inventory, which I personally have not seen. So it'd be great to have access to that. And then just sort of lay out the steps for staff for projects in Skidmore so that they can connect with Prosper Portland and connect the applicants to Prosper. And so that it's like a triangulation of conversation before it gets to you.
That would be great. If, you know, if we can do that internally and then, you know, have that way, you know, that open communication.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously we depend on staff
right.
and the applicant, you know, that's, and of course, you know, various of us have, you know, various expertise that we bring, but that does change all the time, you know, like Maya was saying. So,
I just have one more thought. Is it possible to leverage the Burnside Bridge project to get some funding to do a bigger interpretive effort and take a, because you guys don't want to store that. You're going to end up with like one piece someday.
I mean,
right?
mitigation.
You need a project plan that says here's how we, you know, go from where we're at today to where we want to be. And anyway, it just seems like they're going to need some. I'm looking at the bridge as it goes by there, and it's like, oh, you know, maybe this is a perfect opportunity to, you know, get a win back for the cast iron somehow. Anyway,
that's a great idea.
I have one question, because it seems like the PAE project has sort of prompted all of this. When did you become aware of that? You've talked about having some interaction with them, but was it after the first DAR? Was it not even until after the land use hearing?
I believe it was before the first DAR, and I don't know if it was just they were curious and called or if they had been directed through the pre-application process to kind of contact us. So they called. We toured the site. We identified the three pieces from that property, and that's when Bill had a couple of work sessions with them. And then everything went quiet. And this is another challenge we've identified. You talk about us attending DARs and pre-applications and so on, but we're not on the mailing list, even though we own a piece that, you know, because we're not a neighbor. We're not in whoever gets those notices, we don't get them. So what happened is everything went quiet. I don't know the status. Like, I've got my other work doing. And then, but apparently there were DARs and there was a decision made, but we weren't aware that that process was going on or what decisions were being made. And then the next thing that happened was they called and asked if they could use two of the columns in the lobby. And that's when we kind of said, how did we get to the point where now we're just talking about two of the pieces in the lobby and not the whole archway someplace in a more suitable location? So that's what happened.
Okay. Well, maybe that's a missing link, too. I mean, you're a public or at least quasi-public agency.
We're part of the city.
When there's a DAR, when there's a hearing in front of a Landmarks Commission that is in Old Town District, can you just be notified of it? And because it would be really helpful for you to, you know, for someone to come and say, hey, there's this collection and there's a guideline that dictates that it gets reintegrated.
Yeah, that should be pretty easy. Just adding that to the mailing list, you know, whenever there is a Skidmore. You know,
well,
Old Town.
Yeah, proposal. Most likely you'll get all of our mailing notices.
Probably so.
That's the answer I get.
That's
so
true.
Well, we're better equipped to ask the right questions now, too. You know, is there any cast iron in the collection from this site? Mm-hmm. You know, that'd be the first question. Are you on the priority list?
And have you actually looked at, you know, page four of the inventory and, you know.
The question came up about iron from buildings that were that Eric salvaged from outside the district.
Right.
Well, I am not a purist, and I've certainly pushed of the buildings that he did salvage, the complete sets, I've certainly pushed for as far as reconstructing them. Well, that's controversial from the first gasp. No, Europe has decided if the best of their early buildings, their historical site buildings, were important to their culture, important to their effect, the reason for they are themselves, why they're special, different, is to reconstruct their historic squares. You go all over Europe, Eastern Europe, and there's a reconstructed square. Huge pride in that. That is not translated to this country whatsoever. It is okay, Sturbridge Village is okay, no, this historic city or that historic city, but in this case, it seems like you're meeting such a mountain of resistance. But you look at those buildings and, no, they have all the essence of what the buildings had. They were arched. Well, nobody does arches today. No, most of them were arched. You get a feeling of an arched city on a lot of these. All right, some of them had beams and columns. But that rhythm is irreplaceable. To my mind, as simple as they were, or as Baroque as they were well-conceived architecture of their time. I look at that and say, my God, that's a damn good-looking building. They managed to make cast iron really integrated with the whole damn thing. They got all the window space and light that they wanted. What a marvelous invention. And know that feeling of the district, an Italianate feeling of buildings that clearly went with each other, is something we will never see again. Every architect wants to do his thing, and it's so different from his neighbor that there's just a cleavage between any sense of unity. And certainly, you look at downtown Portland, and you have to judge an entirely different basis. This building is totally different than this building. It's totally different than this building. And there's no street facade anymore. That may be good in its own manner, but this district had buildings on the street, and at least around the fountain, 90% of the buildings were arched. Well, how do you talk to an architect who doesn't even know what an arch is? And well, how do you do that? Arches today? You know, you're just, it's a blank, an absolute blank.
Well, you're right, Bill, to some degree, and I guess I'm just gratified that, you know, you did at least kind of look at, you know, the most recent building that we did approve, and you would say that its proportions and its yes. scale and everything, you know, fit in pretty well, maybe a little bit big, but, you know, in general, it's our job to consider, those aspects of the architecture first and foremost. And, I think getting down to the details is certainly important. And in this case, you know, with the National Historic Landmark, it's something that we absolutely have to strive to do better. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I concur.
Who is your official historian?
Ernestina, who is not here right now. Do you know Ernestina Fuenmayor?
I don't think I do.
Okay.
Is there a library of Portland architectural history at all? Or?
We have that on staff. Mm-hmm. We don't always have time to peruse it, but it's there for our consumption. I don't believe that we have this inventory, so I'm looking forward to seeing that. And
yeah, me too.
I will put together an SOP. Maybe I'll shop it around to you guys so that you can see what's.
That would be great.
Proposing
getting the inventory electronic.
I think that's critical.
Yes, but also just protocol for communication and
exactly.
You know how to pull in those. You know, the expertise at an early stage.
I don't think it was mentioned, but Mr. Hawkins also wrote The Grand Era of Cast Iron Architecture in Portland, Oregon, which is no longer in print, but if you can find a copy,
we do
it's
have that.
Amazing photographs.
I think we have an extra copy. Copy with him.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I think we have an extra copy, too.
There might be a few these days.
Would it be possible to get a link from the Historic Resources map to, any properties that are within... It would be affected by the guidelines to automatically be kind of connected to information about this so that it's sort of available for the public.
I think it's easier to add something to either the BDS or BPS website about this topic rather than connecting to the guidelines just because that would require a legislative project. Mm. But we can talk about that, too.
Even though it's part of the guidelines. I mean, there's a guideline that addresses
it. But it would be amending the guidelines. Okay. So.
Well, if there's any sort of a group established, all three of us are terribly interested. Prosper Portland owns the collection. They're very connected to this. The Bosco Milligan Foundation, Benny and Jerry, tore down... two, maybe three cast iron fronted, they own them officially. I had to be standing in front of the Smith block when it came down, and ever since they said, well, Bill, these parts are yours, which is very strange to me. I simply don't know what to do with them. But so ownership is very vague, and I had thought one time, well, maybe an interpretive center that would say, this is our historic district. We were founded in the 1840s. We had the first brick building built in 1853. No, we have some of the parts still left, miraculously. A little interpretive center that said the basic reason why this is special to Portland. And it couldn't be big. I mean, if it was just the size of this room, I'd be happy. Large murals, maybe showing the square, some of the best buildings. But that almost came to be when there were to be lavatories associated with the Saturday market. And I worked with Hacker's office and historians. We came up with the most minimal historic outline of what was in Portland, important to Portland, and enough of the buildings and parts to say this is why it is special to us. Well, that would have made me happy, but that didn't happen too. And, you know, it's all on a shelf somewhere. But there was a lot of research done.
Yeah.
I still think it's a fabulous idea, but no, development moved to other types of development for the city of Portland. And while they've been very keen on developing our historic district, something special that bring people to the district, something that bring people who want to invest in the district and give them a rationale, that didn't happen either. There was not enough incentive.
So back again to kind of action items for today. So we feel like this is not just going to be a nice conversation. We all go away, nothing happens again. And, you know, you come back in 2 years. You're doing the POD, is that right?
SOP.
SOP.
Yes.
Got the P, right?
Yeah.
Electronic. So what are the next steps? What are the tangible things that we're taking so this is not happening again?
I'm committing to drafting an SOP, and I can shop that around to you guys so that you see movement on it.
Okay.
We can also perhaps work this visit to the cast iron collection into our tour that we're already planning for March 30th, if that date would work for you. In the afternoon. If that date doesn't work, we can talk about some other time. So those are two things. And then I would like access to the digital inventory.
And then it's on a disk. This is all on a disk.
Yeah.
But if it's all up there somewhere, I suppose that's all you need.
And then PDC will get on the mailing list for projects just so you get alerted. And is that enough?
I can look into that, but it's mostly adding you to every mailing list. So
I'm just going to acknowledge that's kind of a challenge.
Yeah, because there's also, I mean, our early assistance notices are published on the web by neighborhood. So you can see what's being discussed with staff by visiting the website.
I guess the other thing I was thinking, I don't know if you were already thinking about this, Hillary, but in your staff report, in the cast iron finding, I think it would be helpful if there was just like a definitive statement about the the existence of cast iron and the proximity to the site in question. And even if the decision is to not include it, even if it's just a statement, yes, there are six columns from a property one block away. The commission has decided it's not appropriate for use for whatever reason. That way it's very clear that you're at least aware they exist and you've made a decision to not include them. And then at least everybody's, it's in the forefront of your minds. Or you come up with an alternate way of using them, maybe it's in the sidewalk or something else.
But. Yeah, I think the SOP would include a list of priorities on how to use existing pieces if they're known to exist.
So I had one more thought on the sidewalk issue came up again. And so there's a whole government entity that's in charge of sidewalks. And how do we get them to proactive, because they're not, I mean, we're waiting for buildings to develop, but there's all the street work that's going on all the time. And is there a way to sort of get them to integrate, this into their programming of their, they're putting in park benches and doing other things. It seems
have a conversation with PBOT and
invite PDOT in and ask them if there's opportunities.
Maybe
spots.
It's part of our next
the cell networks and all that stuff. The infrastructure that's changing as part of all that. And,
right.
We can do that internally or potentially at the next retreat.
Yeah, next retreat.
And just to join in because I love trying to integrate both the old and new, and I mean, we already have things that are there. We can't integrate now. I think to your point is you have to kind of create that vision for them of what that's going to look like. So if there if there are artists who work in cast iron who can recreate or make it to look like something new, to recreate into the street work, into the city work, to what's going on there already, and kind of give them that vision of what that looks like, and also integrating these pieces into things that are coming along too. So I'm trying to find ways to use the inventory you have for buildings that are already gone. We want to be able to integrate those pieces into the new stuff, but to also recreate a vision out there too, because I love modern artwork. I also love traditional pieces. That's why I do the historical work as well. But how do we reuse your pieces that are there, create markers that talk about what was there to kind of bring the old and the new together? Does that make sense? How do we bring artwork in to see if we can bring it into the city to show Peabody and everybody else, this is something that we create for the whole district that connects everything together. Here's our new buildings that are up, but these are the things that were there to give us reference to what it used to look like, and how do we reuse that to look like something now and going forward without leaving that inventory just sitting there in a warehouse? Because I would love to see it somewhere in some new use, or especially in the actual buildings themselves. But just how do we reuse that all together and just create a new vision of what that looks like for it?
I would ideally love to see Portland kind of set the standard for how you do that integration.
Yeah.
And I agree, we could work to set some priority. I think we have a procedural question here, but we also have some design and tougher subjective issues. But to set, as you're saying, I think that's a great suggestion, to set some kind of vision, but without being too heavy-handed, because I think that's also up to the designers to use their design talents to solve these problems.
Well, sure, so. Definitely.
Okay, we need to kind of wrap this up. I really appreciate all of you coming here and putting together these materials and, you know, pushing this discussion. We needed, you know, we needed to have it. And I hope that, you know, we'll continue to see you on, you know, upcoming projects that, you know, we will have started from an earlier point. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The next couple.